in India, they have a theory about why people enjoy art. And it's based on a distinction between an actual emotion and the taste of the emotion. They say people enjoy art. This includes drama, music, literature, all the fine arts. Because in looking at the depiction of a particular emotion, they don't actually experience the emotion, but they taste it. And the taste is always pleasant. Even when the emotion being depicted is a very unpleasant emotion, it can be fear, anguish, sorrow. But if it's well portrayed, the audience likes the depiction. They taste for example, the taste of grief is not grief itself, but there's a feeling of compassion. The taste of fear is not fear, but it's like excitement. And so we enjoy art not because we're actually experiencing the emotion being depicted, but we like the taste. And this distinction is a useful one to keep in mind when you think about your thoughts, especially while you're sitting here and meditating. Sometimes the focusing on the breath starts to lose interest. Even when you have nice long feelings of bliss and well-being, part of the mind gets bored. It wants some action. It wants to taste some emotions. And so you can think about all kinds of other things. And you have to remember that no matter how attractive those alternatives may seem, all the different worlds that you can create in your mind, actually living in them would be pretty miserable. So don't get beguiled by the taste. And we had an incident of this in my own family. My mother was a novelist, and her novels were pretty melodramatic. She liked stories filled with all kinds of surprises. Incest, intrigue, murder, infidelity. They made for great stories, or at least for very interesting stories. But when in her own life she encountered some marital infidelity, it was the end of her. The sorrow was what caused her death. So it's one thing to imagine these things, but it's another thing to live them. So always keep that in mind. And even the stories, the narratives you like to make about your own practice, about the progress. Okay, you can't attain concentration, and then from concentration you quickly move on to insight, and there it is, liberation. We like to read the stories of the Ajahns, because the stories are contrived in such ways to make them very, very interesting, very compelling. They're designed to make you want to practice. What you miss, though, in the stories is the long days of nothing happening at all, or the long fallow periods in the meditation. Meditations that may be perfectly pleasant, but they don't have any ups and downs. Or the meditations that are actually unpleasant because the mind is unwilling to settle down. Those are the parts that are not depicted in the books. But those are the parts that when you actually meditate, you have lots of experience with those things. So you've got to keep a perspective on your thoughts. Keep a perspective on the stories that you like to tell, even about your own practice. We're here to train the mind, and part of the training of the mind involves doing things over and over and over again. Pulling the mind away from distraction over and over again. Keeping the mind with its object over and over again. Taking a skill that you develop, say, while you're meditating and learning to apply it in daily life over and over again. may not be exciting, and the mind will have a tendency to rebel sometimes, but you have to ask yourself, oh, when you're rebelling, where are you going? If you think of dream worlds or pleasant worlds where you could be right now, ask yourself, what would it actually be like to be there? There's a great story in a John Lee's autobiography when he tires of being a monk and he starts thinking about disrobing. So one night he decides to think seriously about disrobing. In other words, what's actually going to happen? What's it going to be like, really? And so he starts out with a story that sounds pretty good. He gets a job and he gets a raise in pay. He's doing pretty well. And then he decides he wants the daughter of a nobleman for his wife, which in reality would be pretty unlikely. John Lee was the son of a peasant from the Northeast. It's very unlikely he would have gotten anywhere near the daughter of a nobleman, but he's able to contrive a story whereby he actually meets one and she gets attracted to him and they end up getting married. But then reality sets in. The daughter of a nobleman is probably very delicately brought up, and yet for the family to survive, she would have to work, so she gets a job. And then she has a child, but she dies soon after the childbirth, and then he's left with a kid. And her parents want nothing to do with him. So he hires a woman to be the wet nurse, and at first she's good with the kid, but then after a while she is able to work herself into his affections, and they get married. And then she has her own child, and then she starts playing favorites. That's when it gets really bad. He comes home from work at night, and the mother has one version of the story, the first child has another version of the story, and the third child has another version of the story, and they're all fighting. He thinks to himself, boy, I wish I were back as a monk. And then he realizes, of course, I am still a monk. In other words, he allowed his dreams of disrobing to have a good dose of reality. So this is one way of dealing with the allure of distracting thoughts. Ask yourself, if I really lived in that situation, what would it be like? What would the constraints of that situation be? When you think a thought of the different worlds that you could be going to, the worlds of lay life, the worlds of being a monk in the forest in Thailand. While you're thinking of those worlds, so they seem like open opportunities, but you have to realize each of those worlds has its constraints, has its constrictions. And the taste of the thought is very different from the actual emotion of being there. So if your particular thought is really beguiling, okay, ask yourself, what would it really be like to go to that particular state of being? You probably find yourself wishing that you had some quiet time to be by yourself. Well, here you do have quiet time to be by yourself, so make the most of it. If thoughts of boredom come up, question those thoughts, this desire for playing around. There's a sutta in which the Buddha says this is why beings fall from the bliss of the higher realms. They start getting careless. They see some of the lower realms and say, what's that like? It's through their carelessness and their just kind of wanting to play around a little bit, wanting a little bit of change, wanting a change of scenery, they fall. And then just keep on falling. So these irresponsible thoughts, watch out for them. Remind yourself that when suffering comes, it's real. After all, it is a noble truth, and it really does hurt. And the anguish of a mind that's stuck in a particular situation. You're outside of those situations right now, so don't let yourself slip back in. This is why the Buddha says we should reflect day after day after day on those reflections that we chanted just now. We're subject to aging, subject to illness, subject to death, subject to separation. These things are real. And the suffering they entail is real. And in the original sutta, the Buddha advises reflecting not only on that, but remembering that all living beings are subject to these things, no matter where you go, in the Deva realm, the Brahma realm, whatever. We're all subject to aging, illness, and death. That should give you a strong sense of sangvega and a desire to be heedful. Sangvega means a sense of dismay, of a sense of urgency in trying to get out of being trapped in this situation. And heedful means watching over your actions very carefully, realizing that your actions do have implications. They've been making a big deal of the fact that psychologists now studying happiness. Well, Buddhism's been studying happiness for 2,600 years. And it notes an important thing that most psychologists tend to ignore, which is that the way you look for happiness is going to have strong implications. The actions you do, the things you do and say and think in order to attain happiness. If you're not careful, they can have some very unhappy results. No intention is free from ramifications. In other words, everything you do, if it's the intention is dishonest, you're going to have the likelihood of experiencing suffering as a result. Even though it may yield happiness in the short term, there are long-term implications. You can't get away from that fact. The way people live nowadays is based on the premise that it doesn't matter what happens down long in the future, I want happiness right now. I want it fast. And so they like to be told that the only thing that matters is the present moment, or that's all there is the present moment. But the present moment acts as a cause. Your intentions in the present moment act as a cause for things further down the line, on into the future. And you want to make sure that those things that come in the future are skillful. So this means sometimes doing things you don't like to do right now, but you realize that they will lead to long-term happiness. Or things that you would like to do right now, but you can't because they would lead to long-term pain. And your skill in talking yourself into doing what would lead to long-term happiness and to avoiding things that would lead to long-term pain. That's one of the most important skills you can develop, not only as a meditator, but just in life as a whole. So remember the difference between the taste and the actual emotion. The taste of the emotion is always pleasant. This is why we enjoy art, why we enjoy works of the imagination. But the emotion itself often entails pain. So you're doing best not to be heedless. Don't fall for the taste.